I want to thank everyone for supporting us and praying for us, for me and my family, as we went through this time of the sabbatical. Excuse me. It has been refreshing, at least somewhat. It's the time to take a step back and be refreshed was really important. I think was really crucial to our family, and we appreciate your support. That it's okay that we're not exactly strong. We're broken, flawed people, and we can't just plow through things on our own. But we need the support of our brothers and sisters, and need time to rejuvenate, time to rest sometimes. And so we appreciate the support. Especially, I want to thank Gary and Dervin, and especially Josh for the extra work they stepped up and did while I was on the sidelines. Especially Josh with the preaching schedule. I know that was a tremendous load to fill that. And I hate to put people out because I like to be the hero, not the one that everybody has to go out of their way to cover for, you know. We all like to be the hero, right? Like, you know, the chance to, it feels so good. And when we have to step back and say, you know what, I'm not good right now, I need to take a break. That doesn't feel so good. But thanks for being gracious. And yeah, thanks to the men on the team. Also the guys on the Board of Elders and to the brothers who stepped in and preached, who don't normally preach. I look back over the schedule, I saw Dean would have preached. Dawson shared a message. Tim shared one, and Sheldon just did the other Sunday. Thank you so much, brothers, for doing that. What a blessing that is to have men step up and step in, maybe where you're not comfortable, and share. You know, give God an opportunity to work through you. So, thanks to you and anybody else I may have missed. Thank you all so much for what you've done. Well, for a message today, we're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 14. I thought it was going to be a bit of a challenge to figure out where to preach as I'm coming back into preaching after having not preached a sermon for 6 months. And, well, where am I going to start? And I scanned over my previous notes. Well, where did I leave off? And I realized that I'd ended in the middle of Matthew chapter 14, in the middle of an exciting story. And it became clear pretty quickly that I needed to pick right up where I left off. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to look at Matthew chapter 14, verses 22 to 33. A title for today's message would be Two Kinds of Faith. And some of this was spoken to in the songs, especially in the song, My Faith Looks Up to Thee. The posture of that song. I hope you accepted Tim's challenge and were thinking and applying, you know, as we were singing that, and also in Josh's devotional, as again he talked about our posture. I don't think he used that word, but I hope that you've already applied your hearts to that and opened your hearts to that. The message this morning, as I said, two kinds of faith. Listen, it's not structured, split into two neat points. It kind of moves through them, but listen for the two kinds of faith as the message goes along, and I'll give you a hint. They both words start with the letter P. So keep your ears tuned for that and see if you can find them. It should be pretty easy if you're paying attention. I'll try to say them often enough. And the purpose, a purpose statement for the message, and this comes a little bit from what Josh shared about the impact seminar. You always have to have this statement, right? So if you want a statement for that, it would be, give up on yourself so you can rise up in Him. Give up on yourself so you can rise up in Him. So Matthew chapter 14, this is one of the most iconic stories from the life of Jesus. This is familiar far beyond the biblicized churched people. If people have somewhat of a familiarity with Jesus and have heard a few of his stories, they probably have run into this one. Stories often rejected as impossible or discounted as, well, that's just a legend, or, tried to be explained away in some way to take the miracle out of it. But it's a well-attested story. Matthew records it, Mark records it, and John records it. Luke skips over it. But the other three Gospels include the story, and Matthew gives the most detailed account, and that's what we're looking at this morning. So let's read the text. Matthew chapter 14, verses 22 to 33. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was there alone. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost," and they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." The verse starts immediately. The passage starts with the word "immediately." In fact, the word "immediately" is used three times in this passage. So there's a lot of action going on, a lot of quick things happening. Immediately, after what? The first verse, what's the context here? Well, if you remember, which you may not, because I don't remember sermons one week from the next often, because I don't do that well at paying attention. To my own shame, I say that. But the last time I preached, we looked at the story right before this, which is the feeding of the 5,000. So, and that's the context here. Jesus and the disciples, if you remember that story, they were exhausted physically because of all the crowds. They were exhausted emotionally because John the Baptist had just been executed and they all loved him and cared about him. And so they went away to get some rest, to get some quiet time. And they went away to a solitary place, a deserted place on a hillside far away from the towns. And the crowds followed them. In fact, the crowds got so large that Jesus ended up spending the entire day, rather than resting, Jesus taught the entire day. And they all worked hard that day just dealing with the crowds and doing what they did. And as evening came on, of course, Jesus then took the only food they had access to, 5 loaves of bread and 2 small fish, and he broke them, divided them, and fed the entire crowd, 5,000 men plus women and children. And at that, the crowds were ready to take Jesus by force, whether he wanted it or not, and make him their king. And Jesus' response to that was to immediately, as soon as this fervor started building up, immediately he made the disciples, he forced the disciples against their will to get into the boat and go ahead to prepare for their next place of ministry. And Jesus dismissed the crowds, sent them away, and then Jesus went up into the mountain alone to pray. And that's where this passage starts. There in the mountain, praying alone, as he often did, he communed with his Father. Sometimes I wonder, did he sleep? I think Jesus did. He was fully human, so he would have needed sleep. In fact, one time we see him sleeping in the boat in the storm. We looked at that a while back in Matthew 8, I think. But his real food, his real rejuvenation was the communion with his Father. And more important to him than sleep was that communion with God. And so he went up in the mountain and prayed. And, you know, his disciples had misunderstood, but his disciples had obeyed. They went. The crowds misunderstood, but they also obeyed. They went away when Jesus dismissed them. And there on the mountain, he communed with his Father. He had come down from heaven, as he said, in the same context in John 6, he said, I came down from heaven to do the will of the one who sent me. Later on, John 17, he said that the work he was sent to do was to glorify the Father on the earth. There on the mountain, Jesus and the Father rejoiced in each other because Jesus was doing that work. Sometime during the night, maybe midnight, maybe a little after, Jesus, from the mountaintop, looked out across the sea and saw the disciples in the boat. I think it's in the Gospel of Mark that he points that out, that Jesus saw them in the middle of the sea, and he saw that they were struggling. So let's shift focus now to the disciples. Crossing the Sea of Galilee at night, what do you think that was like? My mind went to driving, because I've never really been had much experience with boats, especially not at night. But when our family lived in South Dakota, we occasionally drove, and it was just such a long drive to get to and from here that you didn't stop. It was ridiculous to stop for a night, so you just drove through the night, 28-hour drive. And we usually ended up driving across Iowa on Interstate 80 in the middle of the night. That's usually how it held out. And many a time, I think it was about 6 hours across Iowa on 80. I would just drive and drive and drive and drive. I remember one night I was awake by myself alone driving, and I had somebody had loaned us some recordings of Focus on the Family Radio Theater's Chronicles of Narnia series. And I was listening to The Voyage of the Dawn Treader while driving across Iowa in the middle of the night. If you know the story, it's a fantastical story. They're sailing, and as they get further and further east toward the rising of the sun, things get more and more bizarre, fantastical. There's sea monsters, and then there's this dragon, and then there's these invisible people that they're scared of, and then there's these people that are under this enchanted sleep, and then it's just this fantastic stories, and it's the middle of the night, and there's the dramatic music and the sound of the waves and these stories, and it's really vivid at that point. It was kind of a neat experience, but it was a little weird. But what it does in your head at that point in time. But it kept me awake, and we made it across Iowa. What did the disciples do when they were in the boat going across the Sea of Galilee? Well, it probably took five of them to man the boat, depending on the conditions. You would have had a rudder and maybe four people at oars, or if the wind was favorable, maybe one or two running the sails, and the rest could have slept. They could have rotated through. Maybe they told stories. I think they told ghost stories. They say that sometimes on blustery nights when the clouds are scuttling across the moon, the ghost of Zebulun Bar Isaac roams the surface of the Sea of Galilee, still looking for his lost fishing lure. I don't know. But this wasn't a night for stories, because the weather got worse and worse. The wind on the Sea of Galilee sometimes seemed to have a mind of its own, and this night it was in a bad mood. The wind was like maybe a schoolyard bully picking on them and tormenting them and throwing their little boat around. And they gave up on sailing pretty quickly and resorted to rowing. John records this in his account. They rowed. The wind was contrary. It was being a bully. Do you ever try to row a boat into the wind? Darlene and I went on we tried to do this little adventure camping type deal for an anniversary trip one time. We had a canoe. It was up in Maine. And we had this canoe. We had bikes and we rode around. That was cool. Then we had this canoe and we got out in this little lake up there. And I thought this was going to be great. And it was not so great, because once you got out on the water, it was a little windy there. And it was cold pretty quickly. And the wind, if I remember right, was blowing away from where we launched off. So it's hard to row against the wind, and we realized pretty quickly that if we're not careful, we could get in trouble. We might not be able to get back because we weren't very good at canoeing. I was okay with floating down the Susquehanna River. That's one thing. But to be on a lake in the wind is a different story. And so we got off the canoe and went and did something else, because it wasn't very much fun. The disciples were rowing into the wind, and John says they rowed 3 or 4 miles. This was exhausting. And remember, this had been a long day. So they started the day sad about John's death, devastated. And then they needed rest because the crowds were so thick they couldn't even eat. And then they ended up in this desert and feeding all these people, distributing the food, gathering up the leftovers. And no time to rest, Jesus sends them in the boat, go across the lake. And now they're rowing, rowing, rowing against the wind. They were emotionally exhausted. They were physically exhausted. And they were probably feeling maybe a little bit of resentment toward Jesus for putting them there. Because the crowds wanted to take Jesus and make him king. That's still who they thought Jesus was going to be. The one who was going to be the king, the one who was going to overthrow the Romans. And there was a pretty good chance there after he fed all those people to get this ball rolling, start the revolution. Instead, they're stuck in the middle of a lake rowing into the wind on its endless night. So that's the setting there. And then in the fourth watch of the night, this is the hours before dawn, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning maybe, they saw the form of a man coming across the water. And as they realized that the other men are seeing it too, I'm not just hallucinating because I'm so tired, they start screaming in terror. And they cry, I love the Greek wording, The noun comes first and then the verb, so a ghost it is. Like, we would say it's a ghost, but it was ghost it is. Like, they screamed this, and the form responds, I it is, or I am. That's the way the wording is. They said it's a ghost. They were in terror, and Jesus responds, take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. Or be of good courage, be of good cheer, be bold. And that's the opposite of fear. Fear, take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. Fear is to draw back or to run away, is the meaning of the word. To withdraw. And to be of good courage or to take heart is the opposite. It's to be bold. It's to engage. It's to move forward. But in the middle of that, he said, it is I. And this is a fascinating little word. It's just tiny words. And it carries a wide range of meanings. It could be taken to mean just a casual presence of a friend, like our English, hey, it's me. Or it also encompasses, because of the way it's worded, what he said is, I am. And it also it carries the meaning all the way from the casual presence of a friend to the holy name of God himself. I am. Take heart. I am. Don't be afraid. It wasn't an odd way to say it in Greek like it is in English, but it did encompass that meaning. And Jesus loved to say things like this that had this broad range of meaning when they were all true. He was there as a friend. He was there as a comfort. But he was also the almighty power of the eternal God who is. I am. Do not be afraid. Well, we don't know too much about how the majority of the disciples responded. We know in John, from John chapter 6:21, that they willingly received him into the boat. They were glad about this and they received him. They didn't stay afraid. We also need to not miss that when the disciples cried out in fear, Jesus responded immediately. That's in verse 27 in our text, Matthew 14:27. Immediately Jesus spoke to them. When they cried out in fear, he responded immediately. He was right there. Jesus never delays when we cry out in desperation. His response is immediate. There's one more immediately in the story that's an even bigger deal. Keep your eye out for that as we go along. We don't know what the other disciples said, but we know what Peter said. Peter said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. Now, why would Peter say that? I don't know that that would have been my response in that situation. So I'm trying to understand what he was thinking. Was he trying to show off to the other disciples? Was he looking for adventure? Was he just crazy? I mean, or was he trying to demonstrate to Jesus how great his faith is? I'm the one that can really do it. If you can do it, I can do it too. I'm not sure. I think there's some clues in looking at the words Peter used, but at this point in the story, this is where when we hear, and you'll hear hundreds of songs and thousands of sermons based on this text. At this point, this is where we insert ourselves into the story and say, you know, we're in the storm and you're in the storm and Jesus is calling you to step out of the boat onto the water and step out in faith and be bold. And we use it to inspire ourselves and pump ourselves up. You know, step out of my comfort zone into the realm of the unknown where Jesus is. And he's holding out his hand like Mark Hall of Casting Crowns sings it. And I'm not, that's not a bad thing. That's a good lesson, okay? I'm not criticizing that. I think there's more going on here, though, and I think we would do well to dig into it a little more. Look closely at what Peter said. Peter says, Lord. And again, this is a word with a wide range of meanings. It could mean a polite sir, mister, all the way to a way of pledging allegiance, a sacred statement of allegiance and worship. The word Lord has a wide open meaning in the language, the way they used it. And so Peter has his options open here. Lord, this could go, he's keeping his options open. He could pivot this far to either direction. He says, Lord, if there's a question here, there's doubt. There's two possible ways this could go. There's doubt in Peter's response. Maybe it is you, maybe it's not. And I'm not making a judgment on which it is because I need proof. If it is you, he said, I am. Peter says, if you are, command me. If you want me to believe, give me a command. Now, we often think of this as Peter stepping out of the boat answering Jesus' command. That's not exactly how it was. Peter gave Jesus a command. Peter told Jesus what to do here. He uses an imperative verb, command me. Isn't that ironic? Peter is telling Jesus what to do in this situation. If it's you, prove yourself. If you intend to prove yourself, do this. Command me to come to you on the water. Now, usually when people commanded Jesus to prove who he was, you know, when the Jews said, and this is again in the same context in John 6, when the Jews said, what sign will you perform then that we may see it and believe you? What work will you do? Jesus didn't do miracles for them. He didn't do what they said because he would try to persuade them to understand or to reveal that they were not understanding. But Peter was Jesus' dear friend, and his response was not like that. When Peter responded this way, Jesus simply said, come. It's another imperative verb. It's a command. And, of course, Jesus knew what was in Peter's heart. Peter's show of faith, his bravado was just a show. Peter had presumptuous faith. He believed, but it was a belief that came out of his own heart. He climbed out of the boat and began to walk across the water, buoyed by a faith that he had mustered up in his own mind, a faith that was sourced in his own strength. And how often do we have presumptuous faith? We do our best to ask in faith, nothing wavering, James 1:6. We try to gin up faith small as a mustard seed. We focus our attention and we center our mental energy on believing with every fiber of our beings. And then we take this presumptuous faith and apply it to the need at hand. Maybe we're looking for wisdom for an important business decision. Maybe we're begging God to heal a loved one. Maybe we're preparing to teach Sunday school. Maybe we're preparing to preach a sermon. We pump up our presumptuous faith and then we step out onto the water testing to see if Jesus is really who he says he is. Well, does it work? What happens? Well, presumptuous faith can walk on water. When Peter came down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. Now, was Peter on his own power walking on the water? No, of course not. It was the power of Jesus that held Peter up. The power of Jesus was accessed by Peter's faith, and that's how the miracle was performed. But Peter's faith was flawed because it was presumptuous. Presumptuous faith is our own. Remember, Peter wasn't really obeying Jesus' command. Jesus had told Peter to come in response to Peter's command to Jesus. Presumptuous faith wavers. When Peter saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. This verse comes out very colorfully in the Bible Hub's Interlinear Bible. It says, seeing now the wind charging, he was afraid. The wind was charging at him, like a band of soldiers or a herd of buffalo. How could he not see that? We tend to look at this and say, this is where Peter failed because he quit looking at Jesus. But the wind was charging at him. How could he not see that? It wasn't just, it's blowing and whatever. And where was Jesus at this point? As Peter's walking on the water and the wind comes charging at Peter, where is Jesus? It seems as though when Jesus said, come, he stopped. And he is maybe at a bit of a distance, waiting for Peter. And this is often how it is with us. When we step out in presumptuous faith, Jesus stands back a bit. He doesn't abandon us, but he does keep his distance, just like he didn't abandon Peter. But he allows us to experience the force of the wind and the terror of the waves because he knows that these trials will test our presumptuous faith. It's his plan, and he knows that presumptuous faith fails. Peter was afraid, and he began to sink. And like I said, we often look at this moment, this is where Peter failed. That he looked away from Jesus. He saw the wind and the waves, and he began to sink. And so we tell ourselves, we've got to keep our eyes on Jesus. If we just stare at him with all our strength, if we just stare at him, the wind and the waves will never make us afraid. And we'll walk on the water forever. We'll never sink if we, with all our strength, keep our eyes on Jesus. That may be true. But that is not possible for us to do. We cannot, on our own strength, keep our eyes perfectly on Jesus. Because when it is on our own strength, it is presumptuous, and presumptuous faith will fail. It will always waver and fail. That may not be as obvious as Peter sinking under the water. And it may appear to work. The healing we pray for may come. The business decision may turn out to be a roaring success. The sermon may be a hit. We might get tons of compliments on our Sunday school lesson. Or those things may fail miserably. If presumptuous faith ends in failure, we tend to sink down in despair. If presumptuous faith ends in success, we tend to be puffed up with pride. Pride always leads to eventual destruction. But in either case, presumptuous faith eventually fails. Peter was now genuinely afraid, and he began to sink. His point of failure was not when he looked away from Jesus. His point of failure was earlier, when he presumptuously commanded Jesus to prove himself. And we do this just like Peter did. And Jesus is present. He's aware. He's close enough to care for us. But he is also distant enough that we're exposed to the force of the wind and the tumult of the waves. It's not because he doesn't care that Jesus stands back in these moments. Jesus is not apathetic. He takes this posture out of love, because he longs for us to experience real faith. Not a presumptuous faith, but a provided faith. He allows the wind to show us the weakness of our presumptuous faith so he can provide us with real faith, the faith that comes not from ourselves, but from him. Peter, beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." It's another imperative verb, another command to Jesus, if you will. But this time it's coming from a very different place. Whereas Peter had been skeptical, now he was desperate. Whereas he had presumed on his own strength, now he had fully given up on himself. And it is here, in his love, that Jesus wants to find us. When we let go of ourselves, when we realize that but for Jesus, we will perish. When we come to the place where we have nothing left but to cry out, "Lord, save me," it's then that Jesus stretches out his hand and catches us. It's when our presumptuous faith is gone that we can receive his provided faith. "Lord, save me." Notice that the problem is not Peter's boldness. Both of the things he said to Jesus, "Command me to walk to you on the water," and "Lord, save me," both of them are imperatives. Both of them are bold. Both of them are aggressive, if you will. The problem isn't the boldness. The problem was the presumptuousness. On the one, it's on his own strength. On the other, his own strength is gone and he's crying out in desperation. Well, you know what happened? When Peter cried out, "Lord, save me," immediately, there's the third immediately in the text, immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" It might feel like Jesus is keeping his distance when the wind and the waves are troubling us. But the reality is he is right there waiting for the cry that comes, "Lord, save me." And immediately he stretches out his hand. He stretched out his hand. It's a very active language here. He threw out his hand like you throw an anchor or throw a life preserver. He threw it out. Swift, decisive action. And he caught him. He grabbed him. And this is an intense grabbing. It's like a band of soldiers capturing a criminal. That's the picture here. There was no danger of slipping out of Jesus' grasp. I don't think Peter could have gotten away if he'd have wanted to at this point. There's an image of incredible strength. Also, don't miss the fact that not only is Jesus walking on the water and standing on top of the water, his footing is so firm that he can lift another grown man, Peter, up out of the water and carry both of them on his walking on the water. The strength, the power that Jesus had. When Peter gave up on himself, he was raised up in Jesus. And Jesus said to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" The word doubt means to be pulled in two ways. And on the one hand, Peter's faith in Jesus caused him to walk on the water. But on the other hand, the ferocity of the wind caused him to fear. So Peter was pulled in two ways. He wavered, and that's why he sank, the doubt. "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" I always read this as a rebuke, as though Jesus is scolding Peter. As though Jesus is in effect saying, "My, how weak your faith must have been that you wimped out, that you looked away. You gave in to your fear." But Jesus didn't phrase this as a rebuke. It's phrased as a question. Jesus was not shy about rebuking Peter, if that's what it called for. I mean, it was to Peter that he said, "Get thee behind me, Satan, for you don't treasure the things of God, you treasure the things of men." Jesus knew what it was like to rebuke Peter, but here it was not a rebuke, it was a question. And I think Jesus meant it as a question. Not a question to put you in your place, but a question to make you think. Why did you doubt, Peter? Think about it. Spend some time. Where did it go wrong? Why did you doubt? The answer, at least part of it, is in how Jesus addressed Peter. Peter doubted because he was of little faith. You doubted because your faith was little. Why was his faith little? Because it was his faith. It was his own presumptuous faith. It wasn't the provided faith that Jesus was freely offering. Peter doubted because he was relying on the self. And the self will always waver and let us down. So for us, as we pray for the sick, as we seek for wisdom in important decisions, as we study and prepare to serve, let's set aside our presumptuous faith and accept the provided faith that Jesus freely offers. Now, don't overthink this. We can overthink this until we paralyze ourselves with fear and do nothing. Don't overthink it, but regularly check your posture. Regularly check your posture. Am I commanding Jesus to prove himself? Or am I humbly listening to his voice? Am I trying to prove myself to others? Or am I trying to prove myself to Jesus himself? Or am I freely admitting my own helplessness? Am I saying, Lord, if it's you, do this? Or am I saying, Lord, save me? Check your posture. Give up on yourself so you can rise up in him. Now, turning away from our presumptuous faith to his provided faith is important in all these examples that I've given. But there's one place where it's far more important. Turn to Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8. I think we're done in Matthew. Go ahead and turn to Ephesians 2, because I want to look at this verse for just a little bit. Because it says something very important about our faith. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is the gift of God. When we turn to Jesus for our salvation, when we turn to Jesus for the eternal salvation of our souls, we are prone to doing it presumptuously. We think that because we've kept the commandments from our youth up, we can earn God's favor. Or we think because we attend church regularly and participate in singing and Bible reading and teaching, we have what it takes. Or maybe we think that because we dress according to the guidelines of our church and we don't hold grudges against others, we're good. Or maybe we think because we were baptized into a church, sometimes as an infant, depending on the church, sometimes as an adult in other cultures. Maybe because we've been baptized, we've procured a place in God's eternity. Or maybe we think because we've responded at an altar call and prayed the words of the sinner's prayer, we've been saved. Now please, listen, all those things are good. All those things are good. It's good to keep the commandments. It's good to attend church regularly and be involved. It's good to honor the guidelines of your local church and seek peace with all men. It's good to be baptized. It's good to go to the altar and pray that simple prayer. Every one of those things is an important part of living out a life devoted to Christ. And if you're saved, you've likely done many or all of these things. But just because you've done these things does not mean you are saved. Because every one of these things can be done presumptuously. They can be done in our own strength. And the faith through which we are saved, look at Ephesians 2:8 again. The faith through which we are saved is not of ourselves. It is not a presumptuous faith. It's a provided faith. It's the gift of God. He provides this faith to us instantly when we give up on ourselves and cry out, Lord, save me. When we discover that we can't, he uncovers that he can. And when we give up on ourselves, we can rise up in him. And Peter walked back to the boat on the water. The way the scripture words it, the wind didn't stop until they got, the wind stopped when they got back in the boat. Peter, with Jesus, walked back on those same waves through that same wind. Not by his own presumptuous faith, but on the provided faith of Jesus. And when he gave up on himself, he was raised up in Jesus. And this is the picture, one of the pictures anyway, that's presented in baptism. We go under the water and we're raised up. We go under the water, helpless, hopeless, dying in our sins, just as Peter sank because of his doubt. And like Peter, we cry out to Jesus for salvation, knowing that we have no other hope, knowing that our own strength is useless. And just as Jesus pulled Peter up out of the water, we're raised to newness of life. When we give up on ourselves, we're raised up in him. So, what's your posture? Is your presumptuous faith making demands of Jesus? Are you lifting yourself up by your own bootstraps? Trying to prove to Jesus and everyone else that you have what it takes? Or are you accepting the provided faith of Jesus? Acknowledging before Jesus and everyone else that you're helpless on your own? Have you given up on yourself so you can be raised up in Him? Let's pray. Lord Jesus,